I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is visiting us from Vision for You group in Buford. And I do not know Michelle, but any friend of Tim Ridgway's is a friend of mine. So let's hear from Michelle.
Hi, everybody. Okay. I'm an alcoholic, and by his grace, I'm sober now. My name's Michelle. And I'm a member of the Vision for You group in Buford, Georgia. And let's see, my sobriety date is 6/19/84. And I love AA. And I'm especially fond of the Black Partner book. That's been the highlight for me. And although I forgot to bring my book in, which is unusual for me because I carry it everywhere with me. So goes to show you, I just don't remember everything. And my sponsor told me, I said, oh, I'm so afraid I might talk too long. She said, put your phone up there and press the button every once in a while and see how long you're talking. It's like, okay. So I'm here doing what my sponsor suggested, and he's giving me a book early morning. Just in case, I need to have a book close to me. There's something about having a book close to me that I find very soothing. I was born in Florida, and I'm from an Irish Catholic family. There's two brothers, two sisters. My mom and dad loved each other very much. And alcoholism is very rampant in our families. So, you know what, I'd like to, it's interesting because you know how when you're going to talk, you run the story through your head every day for weeks before you get up here, and I have not even thought about it once, so I don't even know what God's going to do here. But there is a particular event that happened to me when I was really young, and so over the years what I realized is how that was the outline of who I am today. It's what made me. I am an alcoholic because I have the disease. And what that looks like is my perception can be very warped. And when I came in and grew up, it was very warped. So my father is a wonderful man. And in the Big Book, Bill talks about golf fever, how Bill Wilson had these brilliant ideas and they'd take off, him and Lois, which is my mother's name, and they'd go travel and it didn't work and they'd end up back and they were broke. And my father was like that. He always had these brilliant ideas. He was a wonderful man. He really should have just played golf. He would have made more money doing that, but that was his true love. But he had this one idea, and we moved up to a place called Kirtland, Ohio. And I'm from Florida, flatland. You know, Florida for me is still my home, and it's paradise. I mean, I knew I never got lost there like I do here. I mean, there was the ocean three different ways. Whatever direction you were going, north you run into land, but south and east and west, you hit the ocean. So it was very hard to get lost. I digress. Okay, God, I'm ready. I'm ready for you to start doing this. And so anyway, we ended up in this place called Kirtland. And here my mother had two kids in diapers. She was an amazing woman. She's still alive. My dad's passed, but she was an amazing woman. She's the matriarch of our family. So we ended up there. And for some, there was no real reason. But there happened to be a pedophile in the neighborhood, and back then they didn't call them that. They called them babysitters. And, you know, it's, for some reason, I ended up being the child that went there 5 days a week, and it was very brutal, and it was violent. And after the first time it happened to me, when I came home, I knew that I was different. The world that I was in before I went there was totally different from the world that I, the eyes that I looked through after that event. And it was to mold and shape me, because it wasn't just one time. It was 5 days a week, we figured 8 months. And after a while, I started losing concept of time, and I was unable to function with people, and I was very quiet, and I was very frightened. And my family is a very Irish, party, jovial, fun group to be around. They laugh a lot, they play together, and I used to stand there and be there and wonder why I didn't fit in. Because, you know, at 9 years old, you don't know what's going on, because they don't really tell you to go home and tell your mother what's going on. And you know, and I was Catholic, and I was going to parochial school, so there was this idea that I thought that, you know, God didn't like me too much. I must be really this mortal sin. And, you know, and it began to, that's how I developed. That's what I developed from. So we moved again, and this time we moved to a place called Parma, and I thought maybe I was free. I thought. And this man followed us there. And the first time he came, I went with him. And the second time, I, for some reason, God gave me an indication on something, and which he does. And I went outside and hid in the strawberry patch, and I said no. And that was to set something up for me where I would say no after a while. It took me a while. I would take abuse for a while, and I said no. But anyway, I was walking away, and I was wandering, and what I did is I wandered into a high school gym, and what happened for me is that the energy when I walked in there was very vibrant and very alive and very safe. And it had nothing to do with the people. It had everything to do with what they were creating around them. Because my world was like really pinholed small, and I fell in love. And so I became a person who exercised to be safe. And I did really poorly in school, because it's kind of hard to focus on what's happening in the class when I'm having daymares of somebody chasing me. So that kind of went on. I did poorly in school. We moved again. We moved to a place called Wildwood, and I fell in love again with the ocean. You know, there's something about the ocean that I can always depend on, and it's wet. It's always wet. And these were the little things that I had to hold on to in my life, was little things that I could depend on. And I learned to surf, and so I was in love. And so that was my life. That was what I did. Everybody else did what they did, and I did that. And I hung with a troop of boys, and they never wanted anything from me. They always accepted me. And I was just like part of the kids. Let's go. And so, you know, I was a teenager, and I was a girl, and I was supposed to act like a girl, and I was supposed to know how to do all that stuff, you know, get dressed up, go date. And I just could not pull it off at all. It just terrified me. I couldn't imagine playing spin the bottle. It's like, why do you want to do that? I just couldn't imagine it. Blech. You know, so it kind of created a odd, well, they called me weird. It kind of created a weird person. And then when we moved back to Florida, and I thought, oh, boy, I'm back. But we moved out west, and it was far west to me, because I couldn't see the ocean, I couldn't smell the ocean. And that was the first time I tried to commit suicide. And it didn't work too well. I took some outside stuff, and 3 days later I woke up, and nobody knew the difference. And I didn't make it. So, you know, it was just difficult. It was just difficult being a human. It was difficult being in my skin. I couldn't relate to anybody. Only to, well, anyway. So blah, blah, blah. Hadn't drank yet, family drinks. I probably had a drink when I was a toddler because it was the kind of family that would feed a toddler a beer and say, well, you're having a barbecue, and they watch them kind of trip around. It wasn't mean. They know better now. But, you know, back then, that was nothing. Kid a beer. And but I don't recall, and I was a teenager when I had my first drink, and my father was really important to me. I seemed to really need his something from him, but I didn't know because he was a man. And what I've grown to know is that I needed his respect, and I needed him to approve of me. And so we butt heads because of that, because I couldn't communicate. It was like I was an odd duck, and my brothers used to make fun of me, and it was fun. It was fun. And where am I? Okay, so graduate, and I want to show my dad I'm something. And I don't know what to be. I have no indication from God. And from the time that that happened to me on a daily basis, my prayer to God was to die. I obsessed about it unless I was surfing or exercising and I was thinking about dying. And that was what I was. And so I went to Wildwood and I worked in a surf shop with these two Hawaiian guys. And we made surfboards in the morning and went surfing in the afternoon. And I met my cousin. I thought, cool. And he gave me this outside thing called Christmas tree. And he was studying to be a priest, so I thought it was fine. You know, a little vitamin. I don't know what it was. But, you know, come to find out it was speed. And I started taking that stuff, and they found me. I was in an attic for 3 days, and I was in a fever and pretty near close to death. I remember my grandmother and my grandfather standing at the bottom of the bed, and all of a sudden, I left my body, went to the corner of the room, and I experienced this freedom and this light and this safety. And I thought, this is it. I'm done. This is good. And I, you know, and my older brother came running in and threw ice in my face. And I slapped back down in my body, and I was pissed. I was enraged. And, you know, you take rage and you make it quiet, and it's depression. And I didn't talk much, if you can imagine that, right? I was not animated at all. And I went home, and I just wandered around on the ocean and couldn't figure out what to do. And a friend of the family, I ended up touring the country for 3.5 months, and the main object of that quest was to find waterfalls. So I hiked to all kinds of places to find waterfalls. And what I did at night is I learned how to drink fine wine. So I became a connoisseur of fine wine. But, you know, I had to drink like 2 bottles a night. So that was the beginning of my drinking. I can't ever remember a time when I had fun drinking. I sponsor a lot of girls, and I've heard a lot of stories, and people tell their stories and how much fun they had. And for me, when I discovered drinking, I realized that I could breathe again. That's what it did for me, drinking and outside influences. I could breathe. And God gave that to me to survive until I could wake up to what was really happening in my life. And so I came home, and I was on a mountaintop in Kootenay. It's in Canada. It's a big, hot mountaintop. It's way up in the timberline, so the air is different. And, you know, take a Florida girl, put her way up there. And so I was amazed. And I was talking to God, because I talked to God a lot. I had a relationship with God, but I also had this idea that I was not worthy. There was something wrong with me, but I talked to God all the time. Take my life. I need to die. It's okay. And he would give me visions. There were nightmares, but there were visions. And I'd kind of have an indication of what to do. And I was sitting up there being depressed. And he put an idea in my head to become a hairdresser. And so I called my mom, and I said, Mom, I'm coming home. I'm going to be a hairdresser. And she's like, cool. Because my family are in the service business. My dad was a bartender. And so that was how our family were serving people. So to be a hairdresser was a notch up. And so I thought I was doing something for my father. So I went home. I went to school. I did really good. And, you know, at that time my father and I butt heads because I was pissed and it was his fault. And so I disrespected him one night, and he decided to kick me out, and I deserved it. So I moved out to the beach and got three jobs, and got I'm really a hard worker because I could turn my will into that, you know. And I wasn't drinking much because I trained a lot. I was really into athletics, and I trained a lot, and so I could drink about a beer and a half. I'd sit there and peel the labels off of a Heineken, and they'd wait for me to get goofy. And I'd have to go home, make air. When I could peel a label off a Heineken and fold it into an airplane, they knew I was close. And I got home, and by the time I was 21, I was driving a Mercedes, and I was a legend in my own mind, and I was, like, really infamous and blah, blah, blah. And so I decided to take my Mercedes home to my father and show him that I'm successful. He could be proud of me. And so I drove home, and he was drinking, and he was not interested or impressed at all, period. So it shifted something into me. So I decided, I got home, and I got into black market, and I did black market in the night, and I was a hairdresser during the day, and I began to live one of those separate lives, you know, two different lifestyles, really big. And life got fast, and it got big, and I made a lot of money, and then I had this idea. I was going to open a shop in Coconut Grove, and you know, I had these dreams all the time, and I had this one dream where I was in a head-on collision, and it's a yellow car, and I was going to die, and I was like kind of waiting for that one to come up, you know. And I still wasn't, I drank, but it wasn't, you know, I wasn't over the line yet, even though I was over the line from the moment I drank it. I just wasn't out of control as badly. And I was driving home to, I live south, and this yellow car was coming, and it was the beginning of a head-on, and I was like, okay, cool, God, this is good. And in the last moment, I took my hands off the steering wheel and said, God, help me. And it was a pretty bad collision, and I got a new face, and they said I wouldn't be able to work and exercise anymore. But the thing that happened for me that was most poignant was that here I was going to have this accident and maybe die, and I'm asking God to save me. So I realized in that moment that I was a chicken shit. And, you know, I was a liar. I was the depth of my lying was starting to grow inside of me, that inside part of us that begins to die. I was just like, I was already dead, but I thought I could manage well if I was this person. And it took a year for me to get back on my feet. And I got a new face for Christmas. This isn't the one I was born with. And for the first 3 months, I believed the doctors. I thought, okay, they're right. I'm not going to be able to do this anymore. I'm not going to be able to do my, I'm not going to be able to exercise. And I did that. And I took the drugs, you know, and I got all goofy on the drugs like that. And then I had this thought that the body is a magnificent machine and it can heal itself. There has to be a way. And in that thought, people started coming into my life that were into holistic things. And a year later, I got into competitive roller skating and toured the country and competed. So, you know, it was like, okay, yeah, you say I'm dead, but I'm not. So there was a part of me that always wanted to fight to live, although there was that other part of me that was just as strong that fought to die. And, you know, that separated person that we become when I, yet the spiritual malady gets so intense that I couldn't differentiate the true from the false. And I was skating and I was doing really well and I was at a really big meet. It was like a national meet and I needed to get first, second or third to be a good girl. And I got fourth. And it was really disappointing. And disappointments I know today are as provoking as a resentment. I have to do an inventory on a disappointment. That's how my program works. And we were a real tight knit group, and there was a lot of little kids and young girls and boys. But I was in charge of a group of girls, and their parents came with us, and they were like my age. So they always went to dinner, and I went out to dinner with them, and they drank normally, a couple drinks, but I didn't. It had been 3 years. I skated for 3 years, and it was 3 years since I had a drug or a drink. You know, it's like they talk about in the book, the alcoholism did not stop in those 3 years. It was progressing like, it was big. And I drank, and I drank a lot. And I didn't show my best side to the pros. So I stopped skating, and I got back into black market, and I started using both. And it got very fast. It got very big, and it was hard. And I was very, very separated. And what happened for me is I started to really come undone. I couldn't keep this person over here and this person over here and combine them at the proper time. So I asked for help. I asked one of my customers. They were these customers that have been mine since I started when I was an apprentice, and they were just the sweetest couple. They were Christians, and they loved me. So they gave me a number for a therapist, and I went to that therapist thinking I had hope. Somebody was going to help me. I asked for help, and I went to them, and I thought, okay, good, I can. And I had lost concept of time by now. I don't know about you guys, but, you know, days and nights ran together. I sometimes didn't sleep for a week or two or three. And so time passed, and I had hope, and I went back my second time, and they suggested that I not come back because I hadn't been saved. Now, you know, at the time, I had a resentment to be able to do when I got sober, but I know now it has nothing to do with Christianity. It was just those particular humans, and I don't know what they were thinking, but they said, we can't help you unless you're saved. And I said, I get saved, and they said, no, and I said, okay. So I was a little bit flustered. I had this little tick that I do where I walk around in circles to try and catch up with myself, and maybe I'll get a thought. And I was beginning to do that a lot, and I had other little tickies. And I don't know how long I stayed sober, but I went out to my family's, or I stayed not using and drinking. I wasn't sober. I went out to my family's, and they were having a festive dinner. And they have before dinner drinks, and they have in dinner drinks, and they have after dinner drinks, and then there's drinks after the after dinner drinks. And I kind of made it to the after dinner drinks, and they just were like, you know how people prod you, and you can have one. You haven't had one in a while, and God bless my family. And I had a drink, and 3 days later, I ended up in my favorite little place that I drank on the Intercoastal, and I was a mess. And a friend of mine who got sober 5 years later gave me a bag of that white stuff that you put in a bag, and it was a really large amount. And I went out to the pier and sat on the pier and proceeded to drop it in the water. And I didn't black out, but I passed out, and I came to, and I went in and got my keys and started to lose all my kamikazes, because apparently that's what I was drinking, was kamikazes. And I lived off of Las Olas Boulevard, and there's not too many hills in Florida except for the dump and the bridges. So I was coming up over a bridge. I lost a lot of the kamikaze, and I got my car, and I was coming up over a bridge, and the bridge was going up, and I had those significant thoughts we have, like, okay, I'll fall asleep, or I know I can jump off the bridge, or I know I'll just break through the barriers and jump the bridge. And that's what I did. And I got to the other side, and nobody was behind me, so I thought I was safe. And I got home, and I pretty much crawled into the house. It was one of those drunks where your hair hurts and your ears hurts, and the hair on your nose when you're trying to breathe, it like hurts. So you're like, and you can't touch yourself anywhere because it's just, and my ears were like ringing so loud, and my nose was so stopped because I couldn't put anything else in it, nothing. And I don't know how much time passed. And someone knocked on my door with a six-pack and some other stuff. And I get out of my, no, go away. And so I knew that I was really dead on the inside. And I couldn't play outside anymore with you guys. I couldn't pull it off. There wasn't enough drugs or alcohol that could help me pull it off anymore. I was dead. And so I reached out to my partner, and he didn't use. He just was in it for the money. And him and my lifeguard, bodyguard. They got together and they found a place for me to go. And it was a rehab. And, you know, of course, I was just your regular alcoholic. Said, no, I don't need that. Yes, I do. No, I don't. Yes, I do. Well, wait a minute. No, yes. And he was so used to me that he just used to laugh and wait for me to stop twirling around. And they packed my bag. And they got me all together. And they put me in the car and put a bottle of wine and some other stuff. And they drove me out to this place called Share out west. To me, it was west. Couldn't see the ocean, so it was west. And he put my bag on the curb and patted me on the head and left. Two people knew where I was. That was it. And I walked in, you know, because I'm infamous. I'm Michelle, you know. You've seen my banner on the beach, right? And I walk in and they strip me. First, they took my scissors. So I'm not Michelle anymore. And then they took all my vitamins, so I couldn't be that perfect health person. But then they took my perfume. They thought I was going to drink my perfume. I mean, come on. So that's about how long my defiance lasts, about that long. They put me in the detox. You're supposed to be in detox 3 days, and I was in there. I don't know. I went into the shower, and I just cried. I wept. And something happened for me in that shower. Me and God had a talk, and I had conceded to my innermost self that I was alcoholic and that I'm getting help. Somebody heard me. I'm getting help. You know, there's a power. When you reach out, there's a power there, and it shows up in you guys. And so I don't know how long I lasted in there. I really don't know much about time in the beginning. And what they did is they came in and they put a big book and a 12 and 12 in my lap. And they said, read the book and write your story. And I can tell you what I know about the big book back then. And all I remember reading is that there was black letters. And that still works for me. The black part of the book always talks to you. If you have a problem, if you have an issue, if you have a feeling, all you got to do is go like this. Open a book, and it'll say some. Under only slightly different condition, the same thing is taking place in many, many eastern cities. Like all of us are gathering in many eastern cities, staying sober. So that's kind of how it worked for me. I wrote my little story, and they gave us a sponsor in there. You know, I was totally blessed because the foundation was imprinted on me from the beginning, and I began to have hope. So I did my story, and I told my business sponsor, and we started doing the steps, you know. And I knew I was powerless, and okay, I'm unmanageable. You guys, you tell me what to do, and I'll do it. I was like the little puppy that you could kick and would follow you anywhere. I was willing to go to any length, you know. I had that key that they talk about in the book. And so I did my step. I did step one, no problem, I'm a drunk, I'm an alcoholic, I get it, I'll do anything. And step two, I had a God. My deal with God was I didn't believe that I was worthy of anything. But I knew that I could, that sobriety was being offered to me. So I bought that. And then the third step, make a decision. That was easy. I made a decision, and back then they launched you into the fourth step. There was no thinking about it. You made a decision and did the fourth step. That's what it was about. And I did that. I got on my knees with somebody else who might misunderstand, and we said the third step prayer, and that night I did my fourth step. And the next day I read my fourth step, and we kind of figured it was like maybe I was maybe 7 or 10 days sober. And I did my fourth step. My fifth step with this beautiful woman. She had these teeth and a smile, and she would hug me, and I would lose myself in it because I wasn't accustomed to it. I wasn't accustomed to that kind of kindness at all. And I did my first fifth step. You know, I did the columns that it's set up in the book, and, you know, I got to that core thing about me. I'm scared of everything. What does it look like? I'm scared of everything. I was skin with fear. That's all I was a lot of fear with a little bit of skin on it. It didn't look so bad, so people talked to me. And I got that. I got it. I got that I was afraid that God did not love me and I would never be okay. And based on that, you know, they set us up with a discipline. I was really blessed. They gave us these little meditation books. Some of them are conference approved, some aren't. So I had to do that in the mornings. And I got down on my knees in the morning and I asked God for help to stay sober. And I got down on my knees at night and I thanked Him out of common courtesy. And I also journaled. Because that's the way they set it up. That's what they told me to do, and I did it. And so I did this step, and the next day, I used to have to run because my blood pressure was so low, they couldn't take it until I went out and moved around. And I had done this step, and I went outside, and I had no idea anything had happened to me. And I went outside, and when I walked out the door, it was like, something was really different. It was profoundly different. I could hear the birds. The air smelled different. The sky was just incredible. And I was running, and I realized that I didn't want to die. It was done. It was out of me. And for me, alcohol was only a symptom of my disease. You know, and I just like, okay, no more alcohol. I'm good. And I was excited. I'm one of those really passionate people about AA. I love it. I love everything about it. I love every step. I love all of it. If you give me something to do, I'm on it like white on rice. Now, that doesn't mean I don't have a part of me that says, I'm not doing it. You suck. I'm not doing this. But I do it anyway. And so I did that, and I had this vital spiritual experience that Bill talks about in the big book. And I had that white light again, like I did when I was up in the room. I had that sense of ease and comfort. And I was willing to do anything to keep that, to get that, to have that. And so, you know, they proceeded to take us through 6 and 7. I did 8 and 9. My family came in. My boss, I worked in a really big shop, 23 people. It was fun. It was decadent, but fun. And then people came in, and I did a kind of an amends, the best I could at day sober. And some took it well, and some didn't. My sister didn't take it well. Everybody else did really good. They thought, this is great. Maybe she'll stop walking in circles. And, you know, and I did that. And then they had me do the 10th step. I do an inventory. I still do an inventory. I still write. And the 11th step, they gave us some ideas about meditation. I had done meditation in the 70s, so I thought, okay, you know, I'm caught up with the class here. I got one thing that I can do good in it. Yeah, I got this, you know. So I'm good. And so it was a 28-day program, but they had to kind of vote you out. They brought you in front of a committee, and they decided if you could leave. Well, when it was my turn to leave, they decided I should stay a little longer. Because they liked me so much. No, because I was terrified to go out in the world. And, I mean, I had to go out and be a real person. And I had, 28 days of being in myself and talking to people where people actually looked at me in the eyes and talked to me. Like, my job was talking to people in a mirror. And in my black market, you didn't really look at people in the eye. The guy next to me that was he was the one looking. And it was a stupid thing, but anyway. 11th step, 12th step. So they brought meetings in. I didn't get to go out of that place till July 1st. And that was exciting. Oh, my God. To be out. They took us in a bus to an AA meeting. It was so cool. I was excited. You know, you can tell. But before I could leave, they set you up. Like, we had to put an outline out there of what meetings we were going to go to and what our plan was. We had to have a plan. It was like, okay, got to have a plan. I was big about having notebooks with what I was going to do. I checked things off. It was like, I could control that. So I was allowed to do that for a while. And they said you had to get a sponsor. And every 2 weeks I had to go back there and check in with what I've done. And it's kind of like what you get paper signed now, but it wasn't really. They didn't sign anything. I just it was my own deal. I had a choice in the matter, and I chose to do that. And so I went back, and I was like, oh, I need to get a sponsor. They told me, get a sponsor or you'll drink. And I went, okay. And I was really worried about, how do you get a sponsor? What do you do? So they said, pray about it. And I was like, okay, sure. So I did. And I was at a meeting, and, you know, of course, I'm praying about it, saying, well, I want this, and I want this, and she's got to be this, and she's got to do this, or, you know, otherwise, forget it. We can't work together. I mean, don't you know who I am? And this little lady, about this big, came up to me and walked up to me and said, I've been guided to be your sponsor. And I went, okay, what do you want me to do? And she started me through the steps again, and she happened to be really involved with the Big Book Seminar with Charlie and Joe. And that was when Wesley Parrish brought those guys down. It was the beginning of when Charlie and Joe started their adventure. And I got to be part of that, and I got to be in the service of that. And so twice a year, it was amazing. They would come down, and at the time, in the beginning, they had this Paul Revere group that came with them, and those guys would do the 12 and 12, and then Charlie and Joe would do this animated, encouraging, consuming way of studying the Big Book. It was just amazing. And I walked in there terrified and fell in love again. It was like, how could you not walk? And they had tables and you got books and yellow markers. And I was in heaven and scared to death, afraid to talk to anybody. But of course, my sponsor put me to work. My service jobs, I got a home group right away. Best home group in the whole world. And they put me to work. They wouldn't let me near the coffee. I make the worst coffee in the universe still today. I have a thing about keeping it clean, and you're really not supposed to do that to a coffee pot, not with soap. And so they gave me jobs like mopping, and back then you had ashtrays and coffee cups. So, and I didn't smoke. Back then the meetings had smoke through here. I kind of had to sit on the floor to be able to breathe, and you know. But I was willing to go any length, you know. And my sponsor had me do inventory on these meetings that had cigarette smokes. But anyway, I was doing my first Big Book seminar, and I was, you know, I was like, And Charlie and Joe got to the third step, and we went on a break, and I was scared to death. I couldn't eat with people. You know, back then, early on, I still have trouble doing that kind of. But anyway, and I went home. I still had a house at the time. And I went home, and I was going to eat and then run back. And I ran everywhere. I ran here, ran to meetings. I went to 2 and 3 meetings a day because I ran to meetings because, you know, I'm just so normal. And I got home, and my house had been robbed. And I thought, well, you know, what am I going to do? And I started walking in circles trying to catch up with myself, and God gave me a thought. Why don't you try that third step surrender stuff, because that's where he left us off. And I thought, okay. I said, God, this is really big. I can't handle it. You take it. I need to go back to the seminar. And in that moment, I felt this sense of peace. It was what I call a miracle. And I have miracles on a daily basis. I invite them in. I'm a firm believer in a miracle is simply a change in perception. And it's up to me and you to decide what our perception is about that. I mean, a miracle could be just the ability to see a bird or to talk to somebody or to be able to hear something. And I have a strong belief system, and I said, oh, it was a miracle to me. I was like, it's a miracle. It's a miracle. I was one of those. It's a miracle. And I went back to the seminar, and I was like so excited. And in the beginning, they actually give time for people to talk about what they got from the seminar so long, and they'd ask questions. And so I popped up. Like, you know, that game where you flop and you pump, you hit them and they pop up again, whatever that's called. And I popped right up, and they bought the microphone to me, and I was like, oh, my God, what am I doing? I've never spoken in a meeting, and here I am in front of all, it's like 150, 200 people, and I don't know what a microphone. And I told them my story about the third step, you know, and I felt totally at ease doing that. And it's just, I love AA. If you don't have AA, just like, they told us to carry the book with us always. We took it in our bedrooms with us. We take it in our car with us. We had it at our tables with us. And they used to say, and maybe someday you'll pick it up and read it. And, you know, it's that's a common, that, and when I, anyway, so I did that. And I was excited. So I did the went back and forth, and I started sponsoring after that first seminar, because that's what they told us to do. Sponsor or die. What the steps are, die. If you have two choices, spiritual life or die. And I was like, okay. I mean, I took it that way because that's what works for me still today. You know, I'm like, oh, yeah. And so I sponsored a lot. You know, not all of them lasted longer, but I stayed sober. And I'm still sober today. And my home group then was just amazing. We did everything together. We were just, it was great. There was people with my color hair, and I didn't always have this color. I had brown hair when I came in. And we used to skate, and we did picnics, and we had really big picnics. And, oh, my God, it was so good. It was so good. And I was working the steps again. And my, you know how when you do the steps, And you have amends to make, but you don't really know it until somebody's standing in front of you? Well, in my first year, I had a really, really cool first year. So I had that first robbery. And then my sponsor told me that I needed to call people. Well, we didn't have cell phones. Well, I had a cell phone, you know, one of those big cell phones. But not everybody had cell phones. And there wasn't even phone machines yet. And so you had to make an appointment with people and call them. And I just didn't want to call people. So my sponsor said, well, pray about it. And I'm like, okay. And I broke my ankle sliding into second base, and I had a stick-shift car, so I had to call people to get me to a meeting. You know, God's funny. And it's like, really, you know, it's like, okay, cool. Yeah. And my sponsor spoke a lot, and I spoke a lot, and I had to always go wherever she was. I mean, that was part of it. You know, I was like, And that we had that rule back then too, where you didn't have a relationship for the first 12 years. That would have been better for me, 12 years instead of 12 months. But I did it sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, you know, always. And so where was I? Oh, and it was Christmas, and at that time Christmas was like evil. Forget it. I had a happy family. There's no way I'm doing Christmas. I'm not doing Christmas. My sponsor said, come. I said, okay, fine. And it was a midnight thing, you know, midnight, Christmas. Everybody's doing candles, and they're all happy. And I'm like, God, get me out of here. So I went home, and my house had been ransacked this time. It looked like the elves had been to my house. And my house was built in the 20s. It was a really old house, and it had a whole life history about it that I didn't know until that night. And I walked around in circles and was really disturbed. And on the floor was this, you know, those little camel pins? There was this little camel pin on the floor. I was like, okay, simmer down. And so what I did is I called the people in my home group on Christmas Eve. And they all came over, and we sat on the floor, and we had an AA meeting for my first Christmas Eve. And it was like, how could anything get any better for me at that moment? And, you know, I proceeded on, and we were playing on the beach one day, and I had done the steps again. I'm a firm believer is when you've done the steps, do them again. Maybe you guys aren't as crazy as I am, but God's continually waking me up to stuff I never knew about myself. And how this book, oh, that's a word I haven't read before. Oh, the main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself, and that he lived by spiritual principles. And it's in squiggly writing. It's like, oh. Bill and Charlie and Joe were really big about that, the squiggly writing. They would stop, and they'd pause, and they'd say, get your yellow markers out, because there's squiggly writing coming up. So it's just, you know, I was just blessed. And anyway, we're playing on the beach skating. Because I still skate, I just do competitively. And we were playing on the beach, excuse me, and the policeman, you know, because policemen are like, oh, my God, don't come near me, because they're just doing their job, and I always had something in my trunk. And there was this one particular policeman that I knew since the time I was 21. My first 21 birthday, I got a speeding ticket from him. He was a rookie. And I got another speeding ticket from him when I was sober. So, you know, some things haven't changed a lot for me. So anyway, he was on the beach picketing for more money, and they deserved it because, I mean, their job is less paid than a teacher. We need both of them. And so I looked different then. And, you know, when you're skates, you're even taller, so I looked even more the vet. And I skated up to him, and I put my arm around him, and he just, like, tensed up, and then he looked at me. He's, you know, he just kind of swarmed right back up, like, okay, this isn't so bad. And I said, I really appreciate what you do. And I said, you give me a ticket. And he just froze again. And I said, I just want to tell you how much I appreciate what you do, and I really hope you get the raise you need, and I want to thank you for giving me a ticket, because I'm very grateful for that and what you do. And he was my friend. I mean, he went from this really sweet rookie to a motorcycle cop. You know, he had it with all of us. And, you know, every time I saw him, he'd wave to me, you know, because he was the beach guy. His patrol was the beach, out of the beach. And he waved to me, something like that. And, I felt like that was an amend I never thought I needed to make. But I wasn't really, like, loving towards policemen because they were doing their job and they might catch me, you know. So, you know, we have such a warped mind. My mind was warped when I was 9, but you pour a little alcohol on it and you sprinkle a little white dust on top of it, and then there was me. So it just kind of happened, and then my house burnt down. And so I moved into my parents' garage, and I'd been estranged from my family. And so they weren't really happy to see me, especially the sister that didn't accept my amends. She was not pleased with me. She let me know. And my brother, his result for me, he used to sit outside. I had slept in the garage, and he used to sit outside and get drunk and snort coke outside. And I'd be in there, like, writing my journal, and I'd go to 3-4 meetings and call my sponsor, and I was like, oh God, please help me. So, I mean, I got really close to God. I really got close to God. I was really into the steps. I was, like, memorizing stuff, and I didn't even know it. And I lived there 3 months, and then I moved out. I moved to a place on the beach we affectionately called the Womb. And that was my first year in sobriety. Yeah. Oh, this is really good. And it stayed hot and heavy like that. It's been that way for my whole recovery. I love it. Let's see what happened after that. Sobriety kind of went along, and I was living in my womb, and I had my business. I started a business, so I was making money, minding my own business. And my friends told me, okay, your year's up, you can date. And I'm like, no, I don't want to. Because, you know, I didn't have a whole really good, I didn't really know what to do. I really didn't. I was really naive. And so I dated this guy for 3 days, and I said, no, that's okay. I think I'm done. You know, and I waited, and I did waited a year, and I spoke, and I met my husband. I met this really cute guy, and it was across the room, you know. Oh, he's the one. It was God bless him. He has put up with me for 28 years. God bless him. And we got married, and then had another miracle in my life. I had my daughter. Being a mother is the most profound thing that I've had an opportunity to do and be. She taught me what little girls look like, and what they do, and what they like, and how interested they are in getting dressed up and looking pretty and being cute and being shy. I knew nothing about that because I was terrorized. I talked to her about autonomy from the time she could look that word up in the dictionary, because I wanted so much for her to have a separate life. Because I was afraid when she turned 9 that some of my stuff would leak out on her. Because I actually didn't find anything about myself until I had 7 years in recovery. My sponsor had suggested I go to a therapist when I had 2 years. She said, you might want to go to therapy for codependency. I'm like, okay. Sure. And it turns out that the woman I went to see was, she was like really, really big in the industry of child molestation. She helped set laws and houses for women that were abused. And so God's really funny. So I ended up being in, at 7 years I went for outside help, and I got a minute. 7 years I went for outside help and committed to a group outside of AA and began to have my skin peeled off of me to learn and be healed about what had happened to me. And I've been healing ever since. You know, I have no resentment towards that man at all. And there's a kindness. I seem to invite women that I sponsor that have had that happened to them in their life, and they have no earthly idea that it happened. And that's the job that God gives me. And my husband had a dream and to be a vice president of the company, and he got an opportunity to do that with his company, and we moved to Georgia, and I moved to Georgia. And I was here. You took a flatland girl and you put her in Georgia, and you know, these roads, I live north, and they're like two-lane highways, and animals are always jumping out in front of the car. They want to play tag all the time. You do not see dead alligators on the road in Florida. You don't see it. You don't even see squirrels. People stop for squirrels. So I was like, I'd get to an 8 o'clock meeting, and I was like this. Oh God. And they just fell in love with me. And nobody carried a book. And I was like, how do you do this without a big book? So I started some big book meetings, and I started sponsoring. And it was great. It's been great, you know. And I've just been enmeshed with that. And then I fell sick, really, really sick for 3 years. And my husband kind of got goofy and went on a walkabout and went to Colorado, and he lost his job, and one dog died, and another dog died, and I was sick, and he left and went to Colorado, and it was really a hard time for my daughter and I, and I didn't know he was using, and he'd been sober for 20 years, and alcoholism is a terrible disease, you know, it's really cunning, baffling, and powerful. So that happened. I nearly died when he was away a couple times, three times, and I was really goofy. If you think I'm goofy now, you should have met me. But Alcoholics Anonymous came and picked me up and peeled me out of my house and took me to a meeting and shopped for me, and they were there for me, and they held me when I cried, and they kept telling me to take the drugs for the pain, and I wouldn't, because I knew that I knew that I couldn't do that. And it's unfortunate, because maybe I could have, I don't know. But so I kind of finally, I didn't do too well with that. My sponsor at that time was Grace Robbins, if you guys and anybody knows Grace. And she was just magical. She's praying with me all the time. And I got really, really depressed because the pain was so intense. The world had taken on a whole new color again, and I didn't know what to do, so I asked God for help, and I opened the other big book that I wasn't really, you know, I'd been schooled in it in school, but it you know, I had hope when I moved here, but I opened it up to the book of Job. It's a story about a guy who has everything, and God and another guy, they make a bet to see what's going to happen to him if he can pull it off and stay faithful to God. And so what happens is that he loses all of his money. He loses all of his business. All of his animals die. His family dies. His wife turns on him. And all of his friends turn on him. And he breaks out in boils all over. I could relate. I was like, my life, that's the way I felt. It was like, oh my God. And at the very near the very end, there's only a couple paragraphs. He has all that bad stuff, and then there's a couple paragraphs where he does something. And what he did is he shaved his head, he got naked, and he danced out to the Lord, and he asked for help. And so I thought, you know, I'm a really intelligent thinker. I've got a really sane mind. It's still warped. So I shaved my head, I got naked, and I asked God to help me. People who know me know I shaved my head. I did that. I'm sorry I'm going over, fellas. So I did that, and I began to change. You know, when we ask God for help, He changes us. And I began to change, and I started to come back, and my husband came back, and we were bankrupt, and I got lots of jobs, and I now work for a man who hired me to do something that I knew nothing about, and he trained me. And try to, you know, like computers, if I touch computers, I kill them. And this guy brought me into his office, and I run his office now. I still kill it on occasion, but I have this like really good computer guy that I can call up whenever, like a sponsor. I can call him up, and he'll fix my computer online, and the boss doesn't have to get mad at me. So, you know, my story still is I love AA, and I still go to retreats, and I still study the book, and I carry it with me. Almost 99% of the time. It's in my car, I promise. And there's a part in the book, there's a lot of parts in the book, but one of my parts of the book that I found during that time is that page 42, it says spiritual principles will solve all our problems. And it is like all our problems, not some of them. So, you know, for me, AA is like an exercise. And I do the steps and I do the deal like it's an exercise to get stronger with my God. And I want to thank you all for being here and having a meeting tonight and let me go over. And God bless you.
Thank you, Michelle. That was fabulous. Fabulous. I relate it to a lot of what you had to say.
Running so fast.